Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We have two themes today. The first is the collapse of journalistic integrity. The second will be, who owns the world? Only right now am I going to focus upon the first part. My guest standing by is Christina Borjesson. That's B-O-R-J-E-S-S-O-N. She is a multi-award-winning investigative reporter in both print, television, and radio, as well as being internationally known for blowing the whistle on U.S. mainstream journalism outlets for censoring, with malice aforethought, the truth on major stories, and for being purveyors of false official source narratives. She has the distinction, arguably, of being the most repeatedly censored network television producer of her generation, having had three networks kill sensitive stories they had assigned to her, including two stories on the crash of TWA Flight 800 and on who created and disseminated the false narratives to manufacture consent for the Iraqi war. Remember weapons of mass destruction? At CBS, she won an Emmy and a Murrow Award for her work on the documentary Legacy of Shame about migrant farm workers in America. Christina has authored several books. Her first was Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Exposé on the Myth of a Free Press, an anthology of first-person accounts by accomplished journalists writing about being censored. The book won the National Press Club's Award, the Arthur Rose Award for Media Criticism, and the Independent Publishers Gold Medal Award in the current events category. Her book, Feet to the Fire, about the media after 9/11, was the basis for documentaries aired on PBS and France's Canal Plus. She independently wrote and directed the feature-length documentary TWA Flight 800, in which six high-level whistleblowers from the government investigation of the crash of the jetliner that exploded off the coast of New York in 1996. The show was the channel's highest rated program ever at the time it aired. She is currently the host of the award-winning show, The Whistleblower's Newsroom, on the Progressive Radio Network, which airs every Friday at 10 a.m. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you, Gary.
Christina, today let us focus upon something that seems almost implausible, if not fundamentally impossible, that all of the journalists in mainstream media, and most of them on the cable networks, and we're talking about a lot of journalists, but also all of the experts coming forth to sit on panels on CNN and MSNBC and ABC and CBS and PBS NewsHour, all of these, you're talking about hundreds, if not a thousand journalists, all said the same thing, that Joe Rogan was disseminating misinformation by the people he had on the air, and that was it. He should go. Now, after that, then they began a further attack about his previous statements on previous shows. They took down anywhere between 69 to 112 of his shows. He apologized for not having someone on with every guest to give balance to what was being said. And then he apologized for what he considered poor judgments in years ago in making statements that were clearly inappropriate, but they took all this out of context. Here's the problem. The problem is that the very people he's interviewed, I've interviewed multiple times. The problem is that we, Richard Gale, and myself, make sure that every single major point being made by a guest has been independently documented and confirmed as accurate, irrespective of how controversial or going against the current narrative is. We have never had to retract a statement. I have not had to retract a statement in 55-year career, in over 100 documentaries, 100 books, 50,000 hours being on the air. And yet here they're going after this guy as if he is all bad because he had two people, and mainly two people, he had others, but Dr. Robert Malone and a Dr. McCullough. McCullough came on your program again to talk about fact-checking and who these people are with all these networks that they rely upon to say, ah, you're wrong. Your facts are wrong. You're giving disinformation, misinformation. You're a danger to society, and therefore you should be stopped. You should be censored. You should be erased. You should be shamed. And then it ends there. So the question is, Christina, how in the world is it humanly possible for hundreds of so-called experts on media and misinformation get it wrong, completely wrong, and yet they were all using the same identical talking points, attacking Rogan with the same identical words being used? Please dissect this for us. The forum is yours.
I have interviewed a number of from around the world of physicians successfully treating COVID patients. So anyway, why is that? Well, first of all, if you watch TV all day long, you'll notice that their bills are paid by big pharma. Okay, their bills are paid by major corporations, but especially big pharma. And what's happened to journalism ever since, of course, the commercialization of news was allowed instead of it being a public service. And so it became controllable by, and this is an old story, Gary, you know it better than most, okay? And now it's just reached its ultimate form, okay? Where these people are no longer journalists. I mean, look at Rachel Maddow, who's been misreporting on COVID constantly. What did they do? They renewed her contract for $30 million, you know? These people, I think a lot of them are corrupt and they know it. And I think many of them are not properly trained and they know on which side their bread is buttered. And if they're told by their editor, you know, this is the story, what they do official source reporting. The official sources, of course, as we know, lie all the time, particularly on these major issues. And so they report in lockstep what the official sources basically tell them. So, and the thing is, Joe Rogan is a very interesting man because, first of all, he has a much larger audience. This is why they came after him so hard. He has a much larger audience than any of the mainstream networks. And as a matter of fact, I mean, I think the highest, I think ABC might have 7 million, you know, but Rogan has 11 million listeners and viewers. And these listeners and viewers, you know, he's a multidimensional guy. He's a comedian and he's very funny. I love comedy and I love Joe Rogan. He was a UFC guy, you know, announcer, whatever. And he's a very thoughtful and a very smart man who speaks very plainly and people trust him. That's why he's built such a huge audience. And if you've ever watched his show, I don't know if you have, he's very, very thoughtful. He does his homework. And obviously his shows are produced and he has astute producers working for him, fact-checking and so on. And if he's wrong about something, he admits it right away. So he's built this huge following. And that is extremely, extremely threatening to the whole construct here that has been built around the COVID pandemic. And it basically, when somebody like Joe Rogan has a Peter McCullough and Dr. Malone on, and his audience gets an earful of information that's past the propaganda, and they hear that this is COVID could, you know, with early treatment protocols, COVID is very easily treatable. And, you know, the vaccines are, you know, don't work and they're dangerous and so on. So when they hear this on Joe Rogan, they listen. And that's why that's why all these forces have amassed against him. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to succeed. And what I keep wondering is, when is someone, Joe Rogan even, going to sue these people for defamation? When are they going to have to prove their side of the story? Why, you know, here are our facts, because they don't do that. Do you know of any pro-vax scientist that is out there, you know, attacking McCullough? No, none.
In fact, let's take that as a point where we hear a short clip from your interview on your program of Dr. McCullough. And by the way, just to put it in perspective, they never really say anything about McCullough or Malone. Those are the two people they're attacking Rogan for.
Yes.
But both Malone and McCullough have not just exemplary resumes, but these are people who were at the very highest level of integrity and respect. They work helping the FDA, the CDC, the World Health Organizations. And McCullough happens to have the unique distinction of being the most cited cardiologist in PubMed's history, with over 1,000 citations in the area, especially specialization cardiology and nephrology. But you wouldn't know any of that from his critics. You wouldn't know how many papers he's published in the peer-reviewed literature. You wouldn't know that he's both a medical doctor working in the front lines as well as being a scientist. You would know he sits on the board of many scientific peer-reviewed journals. You would know he's a full professor. You're talking about one of the most distinguished medical doctor scientists in American history. And yet they attack him.
Oh, yeah. And by the way,
of a bus someplace.
He laid all that out. That's the first thing Joe asked him on the show. Joe said, give us your credentials. And the thing is, the real thing is that McCullough is where the rubber meets the road. He's saving lives. He came up with a protocol that saved lives without a vaccine. And that is his great sin.
Remember, there was only one primary drug that was used, and that was supported by Anthony Fauci. It had no real good clinical experience. And the only experience that it had was when remdesivir was used, 25% of the patients died, so they stopped the study. And no journalist has gone there to ask, how come you're not showing that the death was from iatrogenesis, meaning medically induced death? And I believe that the wrong approach was taken, but thousands of other scientists and doctors believe the same, that you have to treat it the first day of a symptom. That's when you go to work on it. And therefore, lives are saved. So we're talking about something that's not just the destruction of a person's reputation if they're wrong, and all these journalists are wrong. It's just like the New York Times being the primary, and Judith Miller at the New York Times being the primary persons pursuing weapons of mass destruction lies. Think of all the lives that were lost, all the homes destroyed, all of the communities had to be evacuated because of their lies. But nobody had to apologize. No, nobody said, we're sorry.
Apologize, so, Gary. People should have gone to jail for a very, very long time. And it's the same thing in this case. And by the way, McCullough's show was the most downloaded show in the history of the Joe Rogan Experience show. And that must have really freaked them out.
Well, because they don't control him. Now, the second part of this show today will be about who really controls the narrative, not the people up front, not the Rachel Maddows, no matter how much money she makes, but the people who control the ownership, who actually own the largest majority of shares in all the media companies. But then the medical companies that are actually making the vaccines and the drugs that are being used, but they don't make money off ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine. They're not on patent anymore. It costs a penny to make a pill. Exactly. No, they want you to take a $3,000 treatment, remdesivir, that kills people. And even if it does, they're not going to tell you the real fatality rates. So that's what makes a Joe Rogan, he's not a part of that payoff system. He can't be given a large contract and said, this is the topic you don't touch. Don't touch it. So good for him for having the courage. And no, I've never watched a show. But let's now hear from Dr. McCullough. We're going to go to a short clip. Again, this was recorded not long ago as a response to the attacks against Joe Rogan with Christina and Dr. McCullough.
Not about being fair and balanced or, you know, on the one hand, on the other. It's what is true. And if you say something, what's backing it up? Is it expertise that's backing it up? Is it a bunch of studies done, peer-reviewed studies done by experts, scientists, people who aren't bought off? I mean, let's face it, there have been some of these medical journals like Lancet. We know what they did for hydroxychloroquine. You know, they put out a, you know, they put out a fraudulent study so that they could get rid of hydroxychloroquine.
Well, I presented the data in a fair, balanced way, which an external continuing medical education accreditation body agreed with. That's as good as we can do as doctors. When I showed Rogan, I think what got the audience, if you ask me, is when I showed Rogan the benefit of the vaccines in terms of the best studies demonstrating reductions in mortality, et cetera. He looked at it, and I think what got the audience, he goes, well, that's not a very big benefit. And that was kind of just his reaction. And I think the gut reaction of people listening was the same. When I showed him the data that the vaccines don't stop transmission, people listening were saying, gosh, you know, we took the vaccines and we're getting sick anyway. I just think that the people resonated with his reactions. No one contested the data that I presented. And you know, I'm glad people listened to every hour of it. And some people just didn't listen carefully enough. Like, so for instance, there was a junior doctor from out in California, University of California, San Francisco. And he said, well, the number of 45,000 deaths after the vaccine, Dr. McCullough should have quoted a study. And he wasn't listening carefully because I quoted the CMS whistleblower lawsuit against the United States government filed by Tom Rentz, where it was the CMS whistleblower who generated that 45,000 number.
Tell the audience, CMS.
So Center for Medicare Services. So CMS is another source of data where they know when someone is vaccinated and they know when someone died. And so by extrapolation, by early summer, the death number was in the lawsuit. I mean, that's public record. That number is 45,000. And the paper I did quote was Pantazakos and Seligman from Columbia University. It's in the preprint server now. They estimate from census data and from vaccine administration data that the real number could be as high as 187,000. So I was pinpoint on those citations. The point is, you know, we can argue about a big, unacceptable number and how big and unacceptable it is, but these numbers are awful. I mean, you wouldn't want to argue a 45,000 number or a 187,000 number or what the VAERS system says at 21,000. You wouldn't want to argue any of those numbers. I made the point that, listen, 50 deaths with any product is off the market. It's gone. It's unacceptable. So some of these fact checkers about fact checking a really big, terrible number is I think looking pretty bad for the fact checkers if they're trying to minimize this.
I think it's worse than that. I don't.
Okay, that's one of his statements. Now let's look at something else here, and I'd like your response to this in however way you can use it historically. You've had a long career. You've had a very distinguished career, and you've worked for the networks. You've been awarded for that. But what do you look back on now and see is the difference in having an open civil dialogue and debate that was accessible to the public at some points in your career where now there is no debate, no discussion, there is no fact sharing, there is no clinical experience shared, there's no background from a doctor saying, hey, I've treated 2,000 patients, true story, Dr. Cole, I've treated 2,000 patients using a combination of FDA-approved drugs, including hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and the monoclonal antibodies and steroids and vitamin C and D3 and zinc, and not a single patient died while under that treatment, etc. That doesn't exist today. Give us your perspective on how all of journalism today has been absolutely controlled by people that we don't know, clearly who are staying behind the scenes, but we can imagine that they're doing so that people don't realize that there could be other approaches to this that did not risk staying at home, quarantining until your lips turn blue, then being rushed to an emergency room where your likelihood of dying was high.
You know, Gary, I've thought long and hard about this. I've had a big think. And I think that the level of criminality over the years has increased because the control mechanisms have been put in place virtually everywhere that you could go for accountability. You know, when the Vietnam War ended and, you know, how many, a million Vietnamese were killed, 60,000 American soldiers and so on, and the whole thing turned out to be basically a war that was based on fraudulent information, just like the Iraq War. And nobody was held accountable for that. It was exposed in the papers. The papers exposed it. So they were still sort of, you know, working on the side of the angels. And they published, you know, the Pentagon Papers for Ellsberg and so on. But as we have moved forward in the history of this nation, major crimes that are committed by the government and large corporations. I mean, the crash of 2008, it's just an unspeakable travesty. The amount of money that was sucked out of the average citizen right up into the pockets of you know, the less than 1%, just, you know, a huge transfer of wealth. No one, I mean, they even came up with those terms, too big to fail, too big to jail, too big. And this is it. This is now truly the history of the United States. It's a series of massive, massive crimes. And this crime is a global crime. And this whole thing, you're going to be talking about the elite in your next segment. This is what it's about. This is about the consolidation of power on the parts of global elites now. Because this pandemic was obviously extremely well coordinated. The national responses were absolutely, you know, in lockstep in the Western, you know, the Western nations. I mean, this is obviously being done by the elite in the Western nations, but, you know, it is a massively global operation. So the press, I mean, the press obviously is co-opted, is now, it's nothing but, it's all propaganda. And, you know, the mainstream press or legacy press, whatever you want to call it. And the courts are completely co-opted. You know, it's sort of the last bastion, I think. And now the ultimate last bastion are just whistleblowers. But the fact of the matter is my thinking process is, how do people protect themselves from what's happening here? How do they do that? If they're constantly being psyoped, lied to, and forced into, I mean, after 9/11, now everybody's used to being treated like a potential terrorist when they go to the airport. It's crazy what people will get used to.
Well said. And anyone who wants to look up Peter McCullough and his work, you can do so The name is MCCULLOUGH. Peter's the first name. He has a very, very popular website.
Yeah, well,
Christina Borsen, thank you very much for all the great work you do, and we look forward always to your programs on Progressive Radio Network. All right, on Fridays at 10 a.m. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break and come right back for part two of our program, where we're going to look at who really owns everything. And unfortunately, they also control most people. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. You're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Now to something that I think is one of the most brilliant pieces of scholarship and rewriting history accurately that I've ever seen in my life. I watched a full documentary about monopoly. And the essence is there are only a handful of corporations that the average person knows nothing about, and they control everything. Now, this documentary, you're going to, in a few moments, we're going to go from clip to clip to clip. And we're not going to need to say we don't have time to play the full one, and we'll show you where you can get the full one. But I'm going to bring Richard Gale in now, because the people, the corporations that are mentioned are so powerful that when you ask who owns Coca-Cola, who owns Pepsi-Cola, they're competitors. No, in theory, they're competitors. But then look to see who owns the majority of the stock in both companies. And it's the same two or three companies. And we're talking about major percentages. They control the board, and hence, by extension, they can control virtually anything in a company. But you never see their name associated. And Richard Gale is here now, our scholar in residence, to take us through why we should all be concerned about this and some of the names that people are going to see mentioned here, and who really owns the company, not who is the president and who's on the board and who is the sponsor of the product, but who really owns the shares of stock, which means they own the company. Richard, give us an update on that, please.
Yes, Gary. Well, I think I just start with what we just recently heard just with Christina Bjornson. And when we speak about certain narratives and official narratives, and why do we hear the same repeated mantras repeatedly over and over again and from many different sources. And this clip that you'll be hearing is kind of going to the heart of that when you really get back, pull the curtain back and see who's at the control tower, you will see this repeatedly, the same large international investment houses, the insurance companies, but in particular, there's four that are just pretty much control almost every corporation, nonprofit organization, news media, both the pretty original sourcing of news, and then what you watch on your television. And those, in order of their power, would be Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street, and then it could be Berkshire Hathaway or Morgan Stanley, Price, R.T. Rose. There's a couple that would fall maybe into the fourth place there. So that's really what we're going to be hearing here, to really have a deeper understanding that there are these guiding voices that are behind all the narratives we hear. And this little clip, this is by a Dutchman named Tim Geetlin. Geetlin would be the pronunciation. So he's from the Netherlands who did this. And you'll be hearing about the three largest nonprofits, the role of the World Economic Forum, which is extremely important right now. There's a section on fear and manipulation, and then just some closing comments. So that's what we'll be listening to.
Okay. Now, we're going to be doing an article on this so we can actually list the names of companies. But Richard has selected different parts of this film, this documentary, that there's kind of silence. You're showing gigantic charts like all the media companies and then what they own. And then you see who owns them, who owns CBS, who owns Viacom, who owns Comcast and Disney. and you'll see it's these same companies. They own everything. Armaments industry, Lockheed Martin and Boeing, they own them. They're the majority of the stockholders. You know, they own the shares. That gives them control. And then you see that thousands upon tens of thousands of board of director members, they're all integrated, meaning there's one circle of power, and they're controlling the entire circle. And by extension, they're controlling trillions upon trillions upon trillions of dollars in the marketplace. That gives them total control. So let's now go to some of the clips from Who Controls the World, this Monopoly game, from the documentary.
Dear fellow human, I think by now you have the feeling that something is not right about our current situation. But I also think that the many ill-founded conspiracy theories may have caused you to distance yourself from both the media scaremongering and from those who spread the conspiracy theories. Still, I hope you will listen to me for a moment, because as you watch this video, hundreds of millions of people worldwide are falling into poverty because of the measures that have been in place for so long. And although the biggest economic crisis that we will ever experience may not have affected you personally yet, it's only a matter of time before the ripple effects also reach you and your loved ones. This is not alarmism, but the harsh reality we face. I also think that we can limit the damage and even benefit from it if we are properly and objectively informed about our current situation. Therefore, I would like to show you some easy verifiable facts that I think are essential. Less than a handful of megacorporations dominate every aspect of our lives. That may seem like an exaggeration, but from the breakfast that's on the table in the morning, to the mattress we sleep on at night, and everything we do, put on, or consume in between, all are largely dependent on these corporations. These are investment companies of immense proportions, and they manage the major money flows on Earth. They are the protagonists of the play which we are currently witnessing. So as not to take up too much of your time, I've summarized the most important information as briefly as possible. How does it work? Let's take as an example a company like PepsiCo, which is the parent company of many of the most popular soft drinks and snacks in the world. There appear to be many different competing brands, but they all come from the factories of a small number of corporations that together have a monopoly on the industry. Within the packaged food industry, there are a number of other major companies, such as Unilever, the Coca-Cola Company, Mondelez, and Nestle. On this image, you see that virtually every well-known brand in the packaged food industry belongs to one of these corporations. You can easily get this kind of information. You can verify it on the websites of the relevant brands or on Wikipedia. Companies of this size are usually publicly traded and have a board where the largest shareholders call the shots. On websites like Yahoo Finance, we can find detailed company information, including who the largest shareholders of these companies are. Let's take PepsiCo again as an example. We see that 73.14% of the shares are held by no less than 3,379 institutional investors. These include investment companies, mutual funds, insurance companies, banks, and in some cases, governments. Let's look at who the largest institutional investors of PepsiCo are. As you can see, just 10 out of the 3,379 investors account for almost one-third of all shares. The combined share capital of these top 10 has a value of approximately $60 billion. But of those 10 investors, 3 own more shares than the remaining 7. Let's remember their names and let's see who owns the most shares at the Coca-Cola Company, Pepsi's big competitor. We see that just like with PepsiCo, the majority of the shares are held by institutional investors. Let's look at the top 10 and start with the last one of them. Four out of these six institutional investors we also saw at the last six of PepsiCo. These are Northern Trust, JP Morgan Chase, Geody Capital Management, and Wellington Management. Now, let's look at the four largest shareholders. Three of these we also saw in the top four at PepsiCo. They are BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street. And there's another one, Berkshire Hathaway. These are the four largest investment companies on the planet. PepsiCo and Coca-Cola are anything but competitors. But also the other big companies that own many brands, such as Unilever, Mondelez, and Nestle, are owned by the same small group of institutional investors. And you don't only find these names in the packaged food industry. For example, let's look up on Wikipedia what the largest companies are within the technology industry. Facebook owns WhatsApp and Instagram. Together with Twitter, they form the most popular social media platforms in the world. Alphabet is the parent company of all Google businesses, including YouTube and Gmail, but they are also the biggest sponsors and developers of Android, one of the two operating systems on which almost all smartphones and tablets in the world run. The other operating system is Apple's iOS. Finally, if we add Microsoft to the other three, we see that four companies produce the software that almost all computers, tablets, and smartphones in the world depend on. Let's see who owns the most shares of these powerful companies. If we look at Facebook, we see that more than 80% of the shares are owned by institutional investors. These are the same names we saw in the food industry. Again, the same investors at the top. Then Twitter, which with Facebook and Instagram makes up the top three. Amazingly, we see that the company is also owned by the same investors. We see them at Apple, but also with their big competitor, Microsoft. When we look at all the other companies that dominate the technology industry and build our computers, TVs, smartphones, and household appliances, we see the same big investors who own a majority of the shares. This small club of investment companies, banks, and mutual funds are also the largest shareholders in the primary industries where our raw materials come from. If we look on Wikipedia for the largest mining companies in the world, we see that their shareholders are the same institutional investors we see everywhere else. The same goes for the largest agricultural companies in the world that our entire food industry depends on. For example, they own Bayer, the parent company of Monsanto, the world's largest seed producer, which produces 90% of all the cotton seed on Earth, as well as the majority of all other seeds. But these institutional investors are also the shareholders of the largest textile manufacturing companies in the world, and even the numerous popular clothing brands that turn the cotton into the clothes we wear are owned by the same group of investors. Whether we have the world's largest solar panel producers or the largest oil refineries, the shares are managed by the same companies. They own the tobacco companies, who produce all the popular tobacco brands in the world. But they also own all the major companies in the pharmaceutical industry and the scientific institutes that produce the drugs. They own the companies that produce our metals and raw materials, and the entire automobile, aircraft, and arms industry where those metals and raw materials are processed. Foundations and funds of the families who are highest in the hierarchy of the 1% hide behind the scenes as much as possible. However, for cases that have a lot of publicity and attention, they use the foundations of philanthropist families that are lower in the ranking, but who are also extremely wealthy. In order to be concise, I will only highlight the three most important foundations in the world that connect all the industries in the world to each other. These are the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Open Society Foundations of the controversial multi-billionaire George Soros, and the Clinton Foundation. A very brief introduction to give you an idea of the size of these types of foundations. According to the official website of the World Economic Forum, the Gates Foundation is the largest funder of the World Health Organization, after President Donald Trump halted the funding of the WHO by the US in 2020. This makes the Gates Foundation one of the most influential organizations in the world in the area of everything that relates to our health. The Gates Foundation has a close partnership with the 16 largest pharmaceutical companies in the world, including Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, BioNTech, and Bayer, and we have just seen who owned the most shares of these companies. Bill Gates was anything but a poor computer nerd who made it to one of the richest people in the world, but he came from a philanthropic family that, just like himself, worked for the absolute elite. Bill is the founder of Microsoft, which is owned by BlackRock, Vanguard, and until recently, Berkshire Hathaway. But at the same time, the Gates Foundation is the largest shareholder after BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street in Berkshire Hathaway, where he was even on the board for a while. We would spend hours if we considered everything the Gates Foundation, the Open Society Foundations of George Soros, and the Clinton Foundation are involved in. Indeed, that controls every aspect of our lives, up to the information that we receive, depends on an unimaginably coordinated collaboration to keep all the different industries on Earth connected to each other, in order to ensure they all work in the elite's interests. This happens at the World Economic Forum, one of the most important organizations in the world. At its annual meeting in Davos, the CEOs of the largest companies on Earth gather along with heads of state, politicians, and other influential individuals and organizations like UNICEF and Greenpeace. Serving on the board of trustees are former US Vice President and climate change guru Al Gore, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink, the President of the European Central Bank, Christine Lagarde, the Director of CERN, Fabiola Gianotti, the Queen of Jordan, the Director of the International Committee of the Red Cross, Peter Maurer, and many other politicians and CEOs of the world's most influential companies. According to the WEF's official website, their annual membership fee ranges between 53,000 and 530,000 euros. But according to the WEF's year reports, around 71% of their total budget comes from its partners, who in this way pay for the membership of young politicians who cannot afford their own fee. Wikipedia reports the following. According to critics, the WEF is a business forum where the wealthiest companies can negotiate deals with other companies or with politicians. The purpose of the WEF for many of the participants would be personal gain instead of solving global problems. I don't like to make assumptions, but would there be so many problems on Earth if the key industry leaders, bankers and politicians since 1971 had gathered annually to solve our world's problems? Is it not strange that the world's leading environmental organizations have been meeting for 50 years with the CEOs of the most heavily polluting corporations while things just keep getting worse for our natural world? That these critics of the WEF are right soon becomes clear when we look at who the most important partners are that account for almost 71% of the WEF's budget. There are BlackRock, the Open Society Foundations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and many other large corporations of whom Vanguard and BlackRock own the shares directly or indirectly. The president and founder of the WEF is Klaus Schwab, a German professor and businessman. In his book, The Great Reset, he describes in detail the plans of his organization. The coronavirus, according to him, is the excellent opportunity to literally reset our society in every regard. He calls this Build Back Better, and this slogan seems to be the motto of all globalist politicians in the world.
And it's now a historical moment, a crucial moment, to rebuild the future, to reset our policies.
And of course, we also want to work together on building back better.
You know, I said we're going to build back and we're going to build back better.
It's certainly a major crisis, but it also offers us a unique opportunity.
We must use this historical opportunity.
Together we can turn a crisis into an opportunity.
But this global pandemic has also created an opportunity to build back better.
To build back better later.
But also to build back better.
To build back a better world.
To build back better.
We can't just build back, we got to build back better.
And achieve the Sustainable Development Goals.
And climate action is an essential part of that.
According to Schwab, our old society should be exchanged for a new one, in which countries give up their sovereignty to an all-encompassing world government, in which people own nothing but work for the state, in exchange for their housing, healthcare, and all their other basic needs. All of this is necessary, according to the WEF, because our modern consumer society, which the elite themselves imposed on us, can't keep going as it is. It's no longer sustainable. Schwab says in his book that we will never return to the old normal. And the WEF published a video that makes it clear that in 2030 we will own nothing, but we will be happy. But for now you may understand well enough with the simple logic that a new world order, or an all-encompassing world government, is the only way for a small elite to retain its power over an ever-increasing world population. Companies like BlackRock and Vanguard do not benefit from national borders, import taxes, and real diversity. Only through fear and media manipulation can they maintain their grip on all of us. And I deliberately haven't even mentioned the inhumane blackmailing methods by which the elite keep their own most important minions in line. Because if this topic has aroused your curiosity, you will undoubtedly find out all about this in time. The elite have no intention to cure us from the countless diseases we've contracted from the toxic food they've produced, and from the environmental pollution which they have caused. After all, if we didn't get sick, the entire pharmaceutical industry would collapse. Nothing sells like fear is the motto of top virologists like Mark Van Ranst. You will be amazed, as I was, when you discover that we have been warned countless times about this elite.
I think we're being run by maniacs. If anybody can put on paper what our government and the American government, etc., and the Russian, Chinese, what they are actually trying to do, I think they're all insane. You know, but I'm liable to be put away as insane for expressing that. You know, that's what's insane about it. I mean, don't you agree?
For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silent, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed.
President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The president is dead. Women here in shock, some have fainted. Real men, Secret Service men standing by the emergency room, tears streaming down their face. There's only one word to describe the picture here, and that's grief, and much of it. It's official. As of just a few moments ago, the President of the United States is dead.
There will be no loyalty except loyalty to the party. But always, there will be the intoxication of power. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you.
Build back better, build back better. You're hearing them all using the same identical language. Then you know that it's a program controlled by many people. We're out of time right now. I'm going to thank you for all taking your time to listen to this. Watch the full film, and we will have a complete documented article coming shortly. Richard Gale, final thoughts on people who are so powerful that they can control virtually all the major industries on the planet.
Well, you know, I'd encourage listeners, take some time and do your thought experiment. Just, you know, try to, in a quiet moment, just try to imagine what you perceive, what you think are the events happening in the world. What if there is, in fact, that there is this enormous economic power of enormous, indescribable wealth that fundamentally controls, and when we speak about control through their investment of all these different corporations, your news media, the pharmaceutical industry, food industry, blah, 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 that means these people's salaries, all the work that's being done, it requires investment. So what he's really speaking of is this small group of these investment houses and all that basically control all the investment going on that run the machine of our economies and our markets and our bank as well as our banks. So just kind of think, if you had that kind of power, what you would be capable of in terms of writing, scripting narratives that we hear, everything you hear on the mainstream media, how you're supposed to live your life, what is good for you, what is not good for you. And just, you know, you can, I think if one does that kind of a thought experiment to oneself, one will really be able to kind of get a deeper sense of what this Tim Gatlin in this film Monopoly is trying to show to us.
Thank you very much, Richard Gale. I want to thank all of you for listening, but remember, this only matters if you share it with other people. If it stops with you, the world doesn't change. We have to change. Get off the grid. We'll be doing more on how to get off the grid and live a higher quality of life, and yet be proactive on the issues that are important for all of us. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening, and have a good day.